we're both kind of nerding out about Churchill and kind of this myth of World War II that has been being discussed because of people like Daryl Cooper and Tucker Carlson talking about Churchill being the chief villain of the 20th century. And I just picked up this book last year and I started reading through it, Pat Buchanan's Churchill, Hitler, and the Unnecessary War. And we were talking before we hit record about just how great of a book this is, and how Pat Buchanan was so brave in 2008 for putting this out at the end of the Bush administration. And I wanted to kind of talk about why it is that you think this World War II myth is so persistent, and why do you think that we keep revisiting it?
So let's first go back to 2008 when Buchanan put this out. Buchanan's thesis is different than the research that I'm doing. Buchanan says one way to look at Churchill is to have a general level of objective morality and determine, you know, the costs and benefits of his actions. But another thing that Buchanan does, which is important, is say, here are Winston Churchill's three goals in life. And how does he measure up to his own standards? First, the preservation and strength of the British Empire. By the end of the Second World War, that was no longer there. We can give him a failing grade on that. This is Buchanan's thesis. In 1945, he focuses on his goal was to stop socialism from taking over in the British Parliament. But by 1945, at the end of Churchill's first run as prime minister, the socialists actually get a majority and end up running Parliament in 1945 after the Second World War. And then the other criteria, I hope I don't forget this. Okay. The third criteria was Churchill set out to stop a hostile force from taking over large portions of Europe. And of course, by 1945, you had the Soviet Union occupying East Germany, Yugoslavia, Bulgaria, Romania, Hungary, Poland, Czechoslovakia. They had an alliance in a few years later with Chairman Mao in China, and you also had North Vietnam and North Korea allying with the Bolsheviks. So if you go by Churchill's own criteria, then he was a failure. That's Buchanan's thesis, and that's why he got so much heat for it. The reason I think World War II is so vitally important is because there is an extremely high cost in order to get yourself informed on things in the modern day, whether it's the Israel-Hamas situation, whether it's Russia-Ukraine, whether it's China-Taiwan, all of these take so much time to research. And by the time you're done researching, the news is talking about something else. So instead of people engaging in deep empirical analysis, they generally lean on historical narratives, such as pure good versus pure evil, Winston Churchill versus the National Socialist German Workers' Party. This is the example we can refer to. So here's the knowledge we have. We're going to take that and we're going to bring it to the forefront. So I have Hitler and I have Churchill in my mind. Anytime I look at a new situation, I say, well, who's the Hitler? Putin seems like the Hitler. Who is against Putin? Zelensky. Well, then he must be the Churchill. So the most famous Churchill historian today, Andrew Roberts, says, you know, that's why they call him Churchill. That's why they call Zelensky Churchill with an iPhone. It's so much easier just to do something like that, that people end up doing it. So the implication is anytime we have given someone with the Churchill stamp, we have to blindly support them, regardless of the costs, regardless of any actions they themselves engage in, such as outlawing 11 competing political parties, as Zelensky has done. Zelensky has engaged in mass conscription. I think it's all men ages 18 to 60. That was the February 2022 edict. He also has a no-leave policy. So he basically has erected a Berlin Wall in Ukraine, stopping people from having the right to leave if they say, you know what, I would like us to be under Zelensky's regime, but if Putin ends up being the regime here, I'm just going to leave. At least give people that freedom. Zelensky doesn't do such a thing. And not to mention, you know, confiscating property from the Ukrainian Orthodox Church on November 15th of 2022. Zelensky, it appears to be a false flag almost, but there's plausible deniability, but it could have been a false flag. It certainly happened. We just don't know what the motives were. November 15th of 2022, Zelensky comes out and says, we've gotten reports that Russia has bombed Poland, and Poland needs to respond. There have been two Polish deaths as a result of this. Putin's aggression must be checked. You know, we can't sit on our hands and knees. We cannot engage in appeasement, this sort of thing. Because appeasement, of course, they associate with Neville Chamberlain, the weak person of the war. The U.S. establishment was surprisingly quiet on this day. I kept refreshing the Twitter feed. I'm like, Jake Sullivan's got to say something. A day or two later, I think it was the next day, Lloyd Austin, the Secretary of Defense, came out, former, you know, member of Raytheon, and said, well, it turns out after further investigations with our Polish counterparts, this was actually a Ukrainian defense missile that hit Poland and killed two Polish civilians. But ultimately, Putin is at fault for starting this in February of 22. So this is what we're playing with. This is the man who we're supposed to say is just like Churchill, and Churchill was totally good, so we got to totally support him. That is a far shot from saying, okay, what are the costs and benefits for supporting him? Why should I support him? If we're fighting for democracy, well, he's no longer democratically elected because he didn't engage in the election that was scheduled for March of 2024, 25. He just passed it. I want to say it was March of 24, but he has certainly surpassed his election term. So instead of having empirical things that can actually be falsified or they cost-benefit analysis formula that you'd usually engage in if you're going to, say, risk 100,000 people to engage in a certain activity, it's much easier to call people Hitler and call some people Churchill to know who you should blindly support and who you should blindly hate. That's why it persists, and it's constantly used as a justification to expand the warfare state in the present by saying, who are you? Neville Chamberlain? You got to be like Winston Churchill. Of course, it makes no sense because Neville Chamberlain was actually the one who declared war against Germany on September 3rd of 1939. What they're generally referring to is the fact that Neville Chamberlain didn't declare war in 1938 during the reunification of Sudeten Germans from the newly created Czechoslovakia into Germany. Herein lies the contradiction of the Treaty of Versailles, which granted peoples around the world the right of self-determination. Well, that would mean that the Sudeten Germans in Czechoslovakia would more or less be under the rule of the German Reich. And the Germans in Danzig, a town that was 95% German, according to Encyclopedia Britannica, the 1938 edition, well, then they also would be under German rule. So it's those difficulties with which are constantly coming across when it comes to saying that Churchill was the good guy, Hitler was pure evil, and that's the lesson for today. Never, never appease. But you also get another contradiction there. If there's a potential threat to our freedom from Vladimir Putin or Xi Jinping or Kim Jong-un or the Ayatollah, we might have to risk going to nuclear war, killing hundreds of thousands at best, potentially tens of millions of people with nukes, if there's a potential threat against our freedoms. But our domestic government in Washington, D.C. can constantly trample our freedoms. James Clapper can lie under oath about spying on us. They could tax 40, 50, 90% of our income. Doesn't really matter. They can constantly regulate capitalist acts between consenting adults, which constantly make us poor. They could forcibly stop us from trading. This is what enemy countries do to other enemy countries in a time of war. They stop them from trading to impoverish them. Well, when the federal government stops us from trading with tariffs or potentially a blockade, well, then we can only engage in appeasement. So that appeasement contradiction is something we always see. Potential threats to freedom from a foreign enemy might have to start murdering tens of thousands of innocent people. But when your domestic government does it, just pledge allegiance, maybe write a letter, maybe start a petition. Other than that, you can't really use it. You can't even go into the Capitol building without a permission slip, or else you're a terrorist and you're going to spend years in prison. But if there's a potential violation of your freedom from, you know, a land 3,000 miles away that you don't know about, but we tell you about, well, then you got to start justifying the mass murder of innocent people. So that's why the Second World War is very important.
Right. And I think a lot of these pro-war types, they accuse people like Daryl Cooper of being obsessed with World War II or being revisionists. But I think World War II history wouldn't be as important as we make it out to be if they didn't rely on it so much. And if they weren't constantly saying that every enemy is like Hitler and that every attempt at diplomacy is like Munich and Chamberlain. And that's really why we have to revisit it, is essentially to say there are more lessons than Munich at in World War II. Like why can't we revisit the Polish war guarantee over Danzig, or Churchill's meeting with Stalin in Moscow in 1942, or Yalta in 1945. There are other reasons to examine World War II beyond appeasement. And for me, I think it would give a lot of insights looking at the war guarantee to Poland, and give us perspective on things like the guarantee to Ukraine, or us backing Ukraine, and what it does for that country's incentives, where, you know, similar to Danzig and Poland in World War II, had they not given a war guarantee to Poland, perhaps they would have negotiated and perhaps Danzig would have been given over to Germany. And then we wouldn't have had Germany and Stalin becoming allied against Britain. And perhaps if Britain would have stayed neutral in all of that, Poland wouldn't have felt emboldened to, you know, go and fight against Germany. And similarly, Ukraine, if the United States hadn't supported Ukraine and signaled to them that they would support them and give munitions to them throughout these last few years, perhaps they would have actually negotiated and we wouldn't have had all of this death in Ukraine.
So here is one of the early lessons that we can get from this. In March of 1939, Neville Chamberlain and Albert Lebrun, the president of France, give Poland a war guarantee. So immediately we see a violation of the country's independence. In order to determine whether men in England get conscripted to fight, get their limbs blown off, die, and get PTSD, that decision is now being transferred from the British people to a number of people in Poland. Now, it's not like they're having some big vote in Poland. It's actually just a few generals who are going to be calling the shots and whether or not they resist the Germans claiming the area over the Polish corridor, which would be Danzig. So here you have the initial justification for the war, which is we must defend Polish independence. This was the declaration of war by France and Britain on September 3rd of 1939. When we talk about this war in retrospect, decades later, that is seldom mentioned to be the cause. The cause, of course, is, well, Hitler was trying to take over the world. Well, we were fighting evil incarnate. Well, we were trying to protect minorities throughout Europe. This is a very, very common thing we see with wars. In order to get you in them, they really scare you or use some sort of like moral entitlement. They then start to, once the war is declared and the troops have been sent there, then they start looking for reasons. Andrew Roberts actually mentions this in the declaration when he's analyzing the Declaration of Independence. He says a number of the things they accused King George of were things he did after the rebellion started. So to say that they caused the revolution in the first place is a little contradictory. In the case of the U.S. Civil War, obviously, when Fort Sumter was being defended by the South, or, you know, offended by the North, in order for Lincoln to get the 75,000 volunteers for the, you know, defense of Fort Sumter and preservation of the Union, he never mentioned anything about slavery. In Lincoln's inaugural address, he had said that I have no intention of interfering with the institution of each state so long as the proper duties are collected by the federal government. We are a strong union, so something like this. But he explicitly said that the war was to preserve the well-being and structure of the Union. Much later did they say, actually, this is for slaves. Lincoln even wrote a letter to Horace Greeley, a founder of the New York Tribune, where he said, what I do with regards to slavery is primarily in regard to how I see the Union. If I could free the slaves and save the Union, I'd do that. If I could free none of them and save the Union, I would do that. You also have the Crittenden-Johnson resolutions that passed in the House. These are the War Aims resolutions of 1861 that don't even mention slavery. So once they scare the hell out of you and get you to start risking your life and getting your limbs blown off, then they start coming up with fake justifications. Of course, the ones that we see today are just too blatant. The Gulf of Tonkin incident, we've been attacked. We have to go defend ourselves in against the North Vietnamese aggressors. Well, actually, we're just trying to stop the spread of communism because it's like a series of dominoes that would come down. We have to go to Afghanistan because we were attacked on 9/11 20 years later. Well, we have to stay because women's rights are violated and the Taliban is very barbaric. Saddam Hussein is about to drop a nuclear weapon in the form of a mushroom cloud on America. Well, actually, we're just trying to bring stability and democracy to Iraq. So we constantly see this. They start you off by scaring the hell out of you. Hitler's invading Poland, then he's going to take over the world. Well, Churchill actually mentions this in the Second World War. He won the Nobel Prize in Literature for this book. And at the beginning of it, he says something. I want to get the quote exactly right just because it's so shocking. He says, "The human tragedy reaches its climax in the fact that after all the exertions and sacrifices of hundreds of millions of people and the victories of the righteous cause, we have still not found peace or security, and that we lie in the grip of even worse perils than those we have surmounted." Later on, he says, "The territories under Russian control," this is when they're at the Yalta Conference in 44-45, he's discussing this, "the territories under Russian control would include the Baltic provinces, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, all of Germany to the occupational line, all Czechoslovakia, a large part of Austria, the whole of Yugoslavia, Hungary, Romania, Bulgaria, until Greece in her present tottering condition is reached. It would include all the great capitals of Middle Europe, including Berlin, Vienna, Budapest, Belgrade, Bucharest, and Sofia." So here we have the war for Polish independence leading to roughly 8 million dead Poles and Poland under Soviet occupation. Of course, it was a fake Polish guarantee because when the Soviets invaded on September 17th of 1939, there was no declaration of war against Joseph Stalin and the Bolshevik regime. So it was just them trying to serve themselves justifications for the future if they ever wanted to. And they didn't really go in and start defending Poland right away. The only country that invaded Germany in that time frame was France on September 7th of 1939. They invaded the Saarland, but really most of the fighting, it's referred to as the phony war from September of 39 all the way till May 10th of 1940 is referred to as the phony war because there wasn't an all-out offensive. So Britain didn't even end up really defending the Poles. And then when the Poles were under the Bolshevik occupation, they had really run out of a lot of cards to play. Churchill is summarizing his discussions with Stalin on this issue. And Stalin says, "Hey, look, I know that you want Polish elections, but for you, Poland is a matter of honor. For us Russians, it's a matter of honor and security. We were invaded by Napoleon through Poland. We were invaded by Kaiser Wilhelm's army through Poland. We were invaded by the National Socialists from Poland. We're not going to let some election decide who is going to answer to who the military in Poland is going to answer to." So he ended up having the Lublin government start calling the shots. And then Churchill goes on to justify this. He said, well, in Poland, you had the London government in exile and the Lublin government who answered to the Bolsheviks. Churchill ends up saying, well, it was the Lublin government who did a lot of the defending in Poland against the National Socialists. And the London government actually was in exile, didn't do a lot of the funding, and had been caught with a number of radio transmitters that they didn't have the license for. So unfortunately, this was just not something that I could keep pushing. According to Sean McMeekin in his book, Stalin's War, he says, Churchill said to Stalin, "What I want are democratic elections in Poland." And according to Sean McMeekin, Stalin responds, "Oh, democratic elections like in British-occupied Egypt." And that was the last time, I guess, they really went head-to-head on it. But yeah, the war that Churchill says we should have gone, we should have declared war over one-fifth of Czechoslovakia, the Sudetenland, all of Czechoslovakia occupied by the Bolsheviks. And at the time, you know, in 1945, you just expended, you know, all of your resources. You couldn't do it at the time, but it just goes to show you that this, we shall never surrender. We shall fight on the beaches. No matter the cost, we will continue to risk it. At some point, you just have to say, the foreseeable costs outweigh the foreseeable benefits. It's not something we can defend. We got to focus on our own territory. So, that is one of the main lessons we could learn that it seems like Douglas Murray and Barry Weiss are not too interested in.
Yeah, definitely not. And I do think you know, the lesson of the moral hazard is much more significant than the lesson of appeasement. And that is why we need to keep bringing it up, because as Pat Buchanan argues in his book, is if Britain would have stayed out and would have remained neutral, it's highly likely that Germany still would have moved in for Danzig. And because it was such a security concern for the Soviet Union, the war would have happened between the Germans and the Soviets earlier and likely would have been ended before. So I think that obviously is a much more significant and present lesson than appeasement, because in Ukraine, we're seeing the exact same phenomenon happen where the United States is backing them and basically it's become a meat grinder where we're sacrificing the Ukrainians in the name of democracy, but Russia is not going to budge. And had we not backed them, had we not given them in effect a guarantee, Ukraine likely would have negotiated much earlier.
Oh, yeah, they certainly would have had the incentive to. I want to get into the early version of Churchill's tenure. He was a member of parliament in 1900 and was until 1965. So there's a lot to go over. I want to mention a few things in his earlier years, because the way that this is sold to us is that Churchill was a great man, fought against the National Socialists, was spearheading this, giving inspirational discussions, which, by the way, Churchill, we have to give him credit. Amazing speeches, just phenomenal. Yes. The guy really was brilliant. Even when you read his books, he's just captivating. So I will give him credit there. But they say Andrew Roberts and Niall Ferguson, Douglas Murray, the big Churchill defenders today, will always say, yeah, he did some bad things. He was fighting Hitler. How could you even criticize this poor guy just fighting Hitler? What you can do in order to determine whether or not someone is worthy of admiration is maybe not look at them in the most difficult circumstance fighting the National Socialists. Look at them and how look at their behavior outside of a, you know, dire situation. If you want to say World War II, we had to fight it. Okay. Let's look at Churchill's actions when he was the First Lord of the Admiralty. This would have been 1911 to 1915. He wrote a book titled The World Crisis, 1911 to 1918. And on page 686, he talks about the attempt to defeat Germany by having a naval blockade around the country. I know some people might think blockades would really stimulate domestic job growth, but turns out it leads to mass starvation. Here's what Churchill says. The British blockade treated the whole of Germany as if it were a beleaguered fortress and avowedly sought to starve the whole population, men, women and children, old and young, wounded and sound, into submission. He goes on, this would have been in 1914 when he was still at the First Lord of the Admiralty. He then authorizes a plan for the invasion of the Ottoman Empire across an area called the Dardanelles against the wishes of a general named Monroe and Lord Kitchener. They said, we're fighting the Germans here in France to take away our soldiers here and have them fighting the Ottomans over the Dardanelles because you're worried Turkey might start sending weapons to Germany. We could lose up to half of our force. And Churchill still authorized the plan. It's referred to as the Gallipoli campaign, but in Churchill's book, he calls it the abandonment of the Dardanelles. And as a cause result of Churchill's actions, it led to at minimum 147,000 deaths on his side, between French, Irish, British, Australian, and New Zealand soldiers. So he ends up having a Dardanelles commission, and they end up pinning the whole thing on him, and he takes responsibility for it and resigns from the Admiralty in 1915. He's then Minister of Munitions, I believe his title was, and he gave a speech in March 3rd of 1919. It's referred to as the Army Estimate Speech. And here's what he says about the blockade years later. We are enforcing the blockade with rigor. We have strong armies ready to advance at the shortest notice. Germany is a very near starvation. The evidence I have received from officers sent by the War Office all over Germany shows, first of all, the great privations which the German people are suffering, and secondly, the danger of a collapse of the entire structure of German social and national life under the pressure of hunger and malnutrition. Now is, therefore, the moment to settle. to delay indefinitely would be to run a grave risk of having nobody with whom to settle, and of having another great area of the world sink into Bolshevik anarchy. March 3rd of 1919, he gave that speech to the House of Commons. It's titled Army Estimates. So he knew there was a huge threat of Bolshevism as early as 1919, because Germany was having a Bolshevik revolt. It was referred to as the November revolutions of 1918 and 1919. Churchill continues to write about the Bolshevik menace in 1920 in an article titled Zionism versus Bolshevism, the struggle for the soul of the Jewish people, where he says, at this point, the Bolsheviks are about to usher in the ideology of communism, which will be as malevolent as Christianity was benevolent. So you see that he has a great enemy. Now that they've gotten the Kaisers to abdicate to the Netherlands and they've settled with Germany, boom, he's off to a new enemy immediately, because the state is the health of war, and war is the health of the state. Goes in both directions. So you can see it very odd when he ends up allying with the Bolshevik regime. When it comes to why he made this switch, there's a very pro-Churchill historian, Martin Gilbert, who wrote a book called Churchill, A Life. And on page 555 of this book, he says, here is the explanation as to why you had Churchill terrified of the Bolsheviks and then switched to the National Socialists. One, he was getting money from the anti-Nazi coalition. It's a group called The Focus, and they were funding him. And that could have, you know, been a primary motivation. But on May 4th of 1935, Martin Gilbert summarizes a discussion between Lord Londonderry, head of the House of Lords, and Winston Churchill. Londonderry says, I should like to get out of your mind what appears to be a strong anti-German obsession. Churchill responds, you're mistaken in supposing that I have an anti-German obsession. British policy for 400 years has been to oppose the strongest power in Europe by weaving together a combination of other countries strong enough to face the bully. Sometimes it is Spain, sometimes the French monarchy, sometimes the French empire, sometimes Germany. I've no doubt who it is now, but if France set up to claim the overlordship of Europe, I should equally endeavor to oppose them. It is thus through the centuries we have kept our liberties and maintained our life and power. So if you see Churchill as someone who engages in war as something that's only necessary to, you know, stop you from getting attacked, well, then his actions don't make much sense. But if you see him as someone trying to preserve his own social status and serve his self-interest, as we in the Austrian school know as a universal, well, then everything absolutely makes sense. And I want to get to the Lusitania, because I forgot about that. Can I mention this briefly?
Well, I was going to bring that up next, because for me, I think the easiest thing to digest for people who want to know why Churchill was a bad guy was his actions as First Lord of the Admiralty. Because in World War One, obviously, the villain is not Nazi Germany. They can't, you know, make that excuse where it's good versus evil. And I think everyone can kind of understand that having a monarchy in Germany and or a monarchy in Europe as opposed to the Nazi Germany party in Europe is significantly better. So in this situation where we have Churchill as First Lord of the Admiralty basically setting the policy to coax U.S. shipping over to Britain, knowing that Germany has a policy of shooting boats with their U-boats, I think this is the easiest case to start with to digest that Churchill perhaps wasn't the friendliest guy, at least to Americans.
Yeah, certainly. He mentions in his book, The World Crisis, on page 438, he says, in these days also came in the news of the sinking of the Lusitania. Included in her cargo was a small consignment of rifle ammunition and shrapnel shells weighing about 173 tons. Warnings that the vessel would be sunk afterwards, traced to the German government, were circulated in New York before she sailed. So a couple things with this. The Lusitania, which was always sold to us as just a passenger ship. It was like a carnival cruise, except it was in May of 1915 off the coast of Ireland. That's what it was. The Germans sunk it. They wanted war with us. Not exactly. If they wanted war, they wouldn't have paid for ads in American newspapers to warn people against sailing on it. Second, if it's just a passenger ship, as opposed to something which is transporting ammunition to the British Empire so they can go kill Germans on French soil, well, that really changes whether or not this was provoked or unprovoked. I'm in no way justifying the singing of the Lusitania, Kaiser Wilhelm's piece of trash, an evil violator of the non-aggression principle. But notice the importance of whether or not an incident or an event or a war is provoked or unprovoked. They will so often say Putin's unprovoked invasion of Ukraine. They'll use something like that in order to plant the seed in the minds of the masses that Putin engages in unprovoked aggression. We have no clue what he's going to do next. Because we have no clue, we can't negotiate with him. There can be no diplomacy. There can be no discussions. He engages in unprovoked violence for no reason. He must be a psychopath. The only thing we can do is start murdering Russians. That is the difference between this situation was provoked and it can be negotiated. There can be reparations. There can be, you know, some people held accountable versus this was unprovoked and they kill people for no reason. The same thing they did with Kaiser Wilhelm, they're trying to do with Vladimir Putin today. So that was a very important aspect of Churchill's own words. He also wrote a letter to Walter Runciman. Walter Runciman was the president of the Board of Trade in the First World War. And this was a note he sent to him on February 12th of 1915. You could find this in primary sources on the First World War at Cambridge. Churchill says, "It is most important to attract neutral shipping to our shores, in the hope especially of embroiling the United States with Germany. The German formal announcement of indiscriminate submarining has been made to the United States to produce a deterrent effect on traffic. For our part, we want the traffic. The more the better. And if some of it gets into trouble, better still. Therefore, do please furbish up at once your insurance offer to neutrals trading with us after February 18th, 6 days away. The more that come, the greater our safety and the Germans' embarrassment." So when you see something like this, you cannot maintain the view that we have governments instituted by the consent of the masses. These governments are here to protect us and our well-being. They don't have an incentive to, because they get money and power whether or not they have the consent of the governed. We don't have the freedom to stop funding them if they provide a bad service. That's why government funding should basically be, you know, a GoFundMe operation. You got to provide a good service. If you do, then we'll give you our money. If not, we need the freedom to opt out of it. So this is a crucial point that most progressives and conservatives just overlook. They say, well, that person is calling themselves a public servant. They must be serving the public. It also gets to an issue with progressives who say that, well, capitalism is inherently bad. And, you know, there have been a number of atrocities of employers against employees. So capitalism needs to be abolished or at least heavily curtailed. If you look at just take the Gallipoli campaign, how many members of the proletariat class were killed because a bunch of socialists, big government socialists, who advocate the definition of socialism, the institutionalized aggression against private property, how many of the proletariat had to suffer? How many were enslaved and conscripted? They didn't want to be there, and they didn't agree to the amount of money that they were getting paid. The progressive is so terrified of people engaging in mutually beneficial contracts between consenting adults that they end up justifying this mass murder operation. Even today in Gaza, you have Crystal Ball and Brianna Joy Gray saying, you know, the U.S. is complicit in genocide. I am happy to agree with that, you know, based on the statements of Smoltrich, the finance minister, and Ben-Gavir, these psychopaths, and also Benjamin Netanyahu. But these progressives have been saying for decades, the government needs more power and they need to regulate more. Keep giving the government power. And then once we give them more power to tax and more powers to regulate, well, then we'll stop the genocides and the wars and the mass murder campaigns and the starvation blockades. They have been fighting to empower the people they're currently accusing of genocide. And it doesn't seem like there's much of a pause and reflection on their point of view. So that's another lesson for the present. All the power you give to the state under the guise of doing good can be used for evil. And it's really hard to opt out of associating with it once they're engaged in these atrocities.
100%. I want to go back to your comment earlier about Zelensky as Churchill. At the time when people were accusing or saying that Churchill or Zelensky was like Churchill, I actually collected these tweets of people saying that Zelensky was Churchill. So we have like Pelosi, for instance, saying Zelensky's speech to Congress, it was similar to Winston Churchill speaking in Congress. And then you even had Bret Baier. So you have Republicans and Democrats saying it. And then Hillary Clinton said Zelensky has led his people and his country through 10 months of war with Churchillian courage and resolve. 80 years after Churchill addressed Congress in America amid the Blitz, our message now must be the same from all quarters as it was then. We are with you. So you just like at the time, this was in 2022, you had people constantly comparing the two. And I actually wrote an article at the time saying, yes, Churchill or Zelensky is very much like Churchill, but not in the way that people are saying. And I quoted Ralph Rako, who was referring to Churchill and his role in as First Lord of the Admiralty. And there's a quote that he includes in his article, Rethinking Churchill, where he says that Churchill said, the maneuver which brings an ally into the field is as serviceable as that which wins a great battle. So you kind of see the sentiment with Churchill being a smaller power, hoping to bring the United States in and luring the United States shipping to their coasts in order to bring the United States into war. And similarly, you have Zelensky currently, I think, relying on the United States. I think it was pretty clear that Zelensky his only hopes in winning was that the United States would eventually enter the war, whether it was directly or indirectly through aid. And even now today, he's still demanding that the U.S. still put sanctions on Russia if they don't cede to his terms in agreement or in agreements on the ceasefire. So I think you actually do have a lot of similarities in that Churchill was relying on the United States and on Russia to defeat Germany, especially after Germany pushed them off continental Europe after Dunkirk.
No, yeah, the parallels are there. I agree with Secretary of State Clinton, but they're there for certainly the wrong reasons. I think one of the biggest things that does not get enough attention when it comes to the Churchill discussions, some people will mention that he had said insensitive things about other races, that he didn't support women's suffrage at the time. I see those as so microscopic compared to the actual things we have. This is what I think is Churchill's greatest crime. This was a policy. You have Neville Chamberlain as prime minister declaring war against the National Socialist Germany on September 3rd, 1939. Chamberlain ends up resigning in May of 1940, it was either the 9th or 10th of May. And this was as a result of the First Lord of the Admiralty, Winston Churchill, talking to people like Joseph P. Kennedy, saying, what we should do is put landmines in the seas outside of Norway to stop the National Socialists from getting access to the iron ore in Norway. Churchill, in his book, says, I called it Operation Wilfred because at the time it seemed like such a small thing to do. Well, word got out. Hitler ends up hearing about this because Churchill talked about it to so many people. The National Socialists invade and occupy Norway. Chamberlain's administration is humiliated and Chamberlain resigns. Hitler then comes out with a speech. It's called My Last Appeal to Great Britain. I think that's the title, in 1940, where he brags about how they heard about this operation and they have so many eyes that the British don't know about. And that's how they were able to win in Norway. If you don't want to see any more Narvik debacles, any more Norway debacles, you will make peace with us now. So the funny thing is that you have Churchill as First Lord of the Admiralty engaging in the Gallipoli operation, killing at least 147,000 people on his own side, not to mention the poor soldiers on the other side getting their heads blown off for the Ottoman Empire. He is then reappointed as First Lord of the Admiralty in 38-39, has this Narvik debacle, Chamberlain takes the blame, and Churchill goes from First Lord of the Admiralty to being Prime Minister May 10th, 11th of 1940. So Hitler then has the invasion of Rotterdam in the Netherlands, starts killing civilians in there. The National Socialist regime is just so evil that I think anyone who tries to defend it, just because you can hate more than one tyrant. It's okay to hate more than one. You don't have to be. Are you a Sunni Muslim or a Shia Muslim? You can be neither. Are you a Hitler or a Churchill guy? You can be neither. So the National Socialists are just so evil. But we get so much of that it's important to change the narrative from good versus evil to evil versus evil, where the masses, the innocent people, actually had to pay the price. So in May of 1940, Churchill authorizes the bombing of German civilians. Here's how we know this. There's quite a bit of evidence, so I want to get through it because it's quite an exhaustive case. There was a book published in 1961 by Her Majesty's publishers titled The Strategic Air Offensive Against Germany, 1939 to 1945. The collectors and authors who provided commentary for these documents were Sir Charles Webster, who worked at the Foreign Office from 1943 to 1946. This guy is in a position to have access to this work. And the other gentleman, his name is Noble Franklin, and he was the general director of the Imperial War Museum. So people who are in positions to have access to these documents. Here's how they summarized the start of the bomber offensive against Germany. Between May 9th and the 4th of June 1940, operating exclusively at night, the Wellingtons, Whitleys, and Hamptons, three bomber planes, of three, four, and five groups, flew some 1,696 sorties and lost 39 aircraft. So recognize the importance of these dates. The 9th of May and 4th of June 1940. The German blitz against London was not until September 7th of 1940. So it turns out, according to these primary documents, not to mention the people who were there at the time, the British Empire not only declared war against Germany on September 3rd of 1939, but in May of 1940 started bombing German cities and killing German civilians. This was also confirmed as early as 1944 by the Assistant Air Secretary Principal, I think was his title. His name is James Speight. In his 1944 book, Bombing Vindicated, he said, "Yes, we were the ones who started the bombing. We should be bragging about such a thing because it is bombing that got the Germans to surrender much earlier than they otherwise would have." So his book, Bombing Vindicated, that's the general thesis, that we should be proud of this because it got the Germans to surrender. So that is one of the sources which says, okay, it's not Germany started flooding London with bombs and then poor London just decided to respond. It was, in fact, the other way around. So that is the first myth that we can get rid of. There was a report in 1941 which talked about the accuracy of these bombs. It's called the Butte Report by a guy named David Bensonson, I think is how you pronounced it. This was August 18th of 1941. He says, "Of those aircraft recorded as attacking their target, only one in three got within 5 miles. Over the French ports, the proportion was 2 in 3. Over Germany as a whole, the proportion was 1 in 4. Over the Ruhr, it was only 1 in 10. So this is vast indiscriminate bombing that's very unprecise. And as he says, it's taking place at night. And he mentions on French ports. So the British are bombing the French, both in Operation Catapult, which was the bombing of a ship which killed 1,297 French servicemen off the coast of Algeria. It's known as Operation Catapult. And Churchill's defense was, look, we thought the Germans would end up taking it. So yeah, we're now killing French people too. Why is it okay to declare war on Germany? Where they're killing innocent people. But when we do it, I promise I have a different motive in my head when I murder massive amounts of innocent people. Okay, moving on. Arthur Harris, who was the Marshal of the Royal Air Force. Again, I'm not doing the Douglas Murray Barry Weiss thing of telling fairy tales and assuming motives. I'm going at the Libertarian Institute. We go to primary sources. Here is what Arthur Harris, Marshal of the Royal Air Force, said in a book titled Dispatch on War Operations. The aim of the attacks on town areas had already been defined in an air staff paper dated 23rd September 1941 as follows. The ultimate aim of the attack on a town area is to break the morale of the population which occupies it. To ensure this, we must achieve two things. First, we must make the town physically uninhabitable. And secondly, we must make the people conscious of constant personal danger. The immediate aim is therefore twofold, namely, to produce destruction and the fear of death. My primary task was therefore clear beyond doubt, to inflict the most severe material damage on German industrial cities. That was the memo that the Marshal of the Royal Air Force, Arthur Harris, you'll know him as Bomber Harris, his book is titled Bomber Offensive, and then Dispatch on War Operations is much shorter. But that is another example of this was not a war against Hitler, or, well, technically a war against his army. Hitler ends up killing himself. Most, 4 out of every 5 Germans that were killed on the Eastern Front against the Soviet regime. And you have these people justifying the mass murder of innocent German civilians, to which it is often responded, well, maybe you could get some people at one point in a big government saying crazy things. Okay, so we've already conceded we have people who are in a position to know about what's happening. Second question, is it widespread? Well, there was another memorandum by Lord Sherwell. This guy's real name is Frederick Lindemann, 1st Viscount Sherwell. This is a letter he gave directly to Winston Churchill. This would have been April 9th of 1942. It says, Lindemann was a science advisor. He ran this S branch, the statistical branch, gathering statistics for the War Cabinet. Lindemann says, in the memo, careful analysis of the effects of raids on Birmingham, Hull, and elsewhere have shown that, on average, 1 ton of bombs dropped on a built-up area demolishes 20 to 40 dwellings and turns 1 to 200 people out of a house or home. In 1938, over 22 million Germans lived in 58 towns of over 100,000 inhabitants, which, with modern equipment, would be easy to find and hit. If even half the total load of 10,000 bombers were dropped on built-up areas of these 58 German towns, the great majority of their inhabitants, about one-third of the German population, would be turned out of a house or home. Investigation seems to show that having one's house demolished is most damaging to morale. People seem to mind it more than having their friends or even relatives killed. These are the good guys in the war, according to Douglas Murray. This was not just something that came, was an idea passed around. Yes, it was against high-level people. Yes, it was multiple high-level people, but it wasn't really, you know, implemented on a large scale. Not the case either. There's a document, TR-1335. This was February 14th of 1942. It's from Norman Bottomley, the deputy chief of the air staff to Marshal J.E.A. Baldwin. I believe his name is Jack Baldwin. He was the acting air officer. You had Charles Porter, then Jack Baldwin, and then you had Arthur Harris. The document says, it has been decided that the primary object of your operations should now be focused on the morale of the enemy civil population, and in particular, of the industrial workers. Every leftist who defends the Second World War and thinks they're so cool for taking on the Nazis, you are justifying an exploitation that is far worse than any voluntary contract any capitalist has ever made with any employee. Far worse than Martin Shkreli, whoever the guy is, the pharmaceutical guy who like charged $1,000 for a pill. Any progressive who justifies conscription, a fancy word for enslavement, and the bombing of civilians is just far worse than that. So The evidence, I have 3 more pieces of evidence that I want to bring forth just to show that this was a policy that was widespread and well known about and kept a secret in circle. So it's another lesson of how governments can be actively conspiring, justifying the murder of innocent people, even when they're the good guys. All right. This is a note. I'll read the whole title. Note by Chief of the Air Staff for Chiefs of Staff on an estimate of the effects of an Anglo-American bomber offensive against Germany. This would have been November 3rd of 1942. It says, a simple calculation based on the results of the German bombing raids referred to in paragraph 5 would suggest that apart from the direct destruction of industries and public utilities, an attack on this scale would lead to the destruction of 8 million German houses. Again, all of these documents can be found by Sir Charles Webster and Noble Franklin in the Strategic Air Offensive Against Germany, which came out in 1961 when they had good access to everything. Next document is in January 21st of 1943. It's referred to as the Casablanca Directive. The full title is Combined Chiefs of Staff Directive for the Bomber Offensive from the United Kingdom. It says, "You should take every opportunity to attack Germany by day, to destroy objectives that are unsuitable for night attack, to sustain continuous pressure on the German people, to impose heavy losses on the German day fighter force, and to contain German fighter strength away from the Russian and Mediterranean theaters of war." So, again, they're attacking German morale. The documents are not saying Hitler and Goering and Himmler and Reinhard Heydrich are our enemies. We got to find them, kill them, and then get the, you know, soldiers to surrender. That is not what these documents are getting into. It's about attacking the civilian population. One of the more horrible ones was October 19th of 1943, report by the Ministry of Home Security on the effects of British air attacks in force on German targets during July 4th to September of 1943. The aggregate details of this table are summarized below. They have a big table with different sections. It's very hard to read, so they summarize it at the end of the note. The aggregate details of this table are summarized below. People whose houses are uninhabitable, 931,000. Other people whose houses have been damaged, 1.15 million. Labor required for repairs, 323,000 man hours. Cost of repairs, 8.06 million British pounds. So, labor force engaged in the first 6 months, 21,000. So not only was there a morale operation, there was a de-housing policy that was discussed from 1941 all the way through 1943 with multiple different chiefs of staff when it came to the Royal Air Force. Churchill unequivocally knew about this and gave it the green light. And the latest one that I could find was January 14th of 1944. This is from Norman Bottomley to Arthur Harris, who was now running it, you know, without hesitation. He's basically calling the shots at this point. It says, "One-third of the town's population is employed in the ball-bearing industry. The de-housing of the town and the infliction of heavy casualties amongst those workers would in itself be a valuable contribution." January 14th of 1944, Norman Bottomley says this to Arthur Harris. Anyone still defending this Churchill regime? Yeah, well, just say that you're as virtuous as Hamas. You're about as virtuous as every IDF soldier who's shooting kids trying to grab aid. It's not that impressive. The main thing is the costs in war are extraordinarily high. They're constantly lying to us all the time, and the outcomes are extraordinarily unforeseeable. So that is the reason you should be against all wars. The example that I used when I was in Tennessee speaking to the Libertarian Party there was, it's like, you know, when you get an email and it says, "Click here, just give me your bank account so I can send you $10 million. You don't know the details of who's behind that. You don't know. So how can you come to a judgment? Assume it's true, right? Well, you can look at the general pattern of how that scam has taken place, and you can say, oh, this is a scam that people engage in. So when you have politicians saying, oh, we got to justify mass murder and it has to be coercively funded, recognize that as a scam the same way you would look at a Nigerian prince sending you, needing your bank info so you could give him $1,000 now and he'll give you $10 million in 2 weeks. It's the same scam again and again. Thank you for letting me go through that.
Of course. Well, after all of that evidence, I mean, it becomes clear why reexamining Churchill is, it provokes so much outrage, because it really is a load-bearing myth for justifying any attacks against civilians, whether it's sanctions policy that is an act of war that clearly hurts civilians and deliberately does so for the purpose of, you know, weakening morale and the hope that they overthrow the population. I mean, the government, that the population overthrows the government through, you know, weakening their economic status as a country. And then hopefully that causes the people to get so upset with their government that they overthrow it. But obviously, we believe that that just causes a rally around the flag effect. But also, you can see why the Churchill myth is upholding the policy in Israel as well, and the policy in Gaza with the destruction of homes and the moving of civilians out of Gaza entirely. So you can see why it causes so much outrage when we try to re-examine Hitler. But I'm wondering, just to play devil's advocate, you've already kind of addressed this argument, but what comes up with Gaza and with World War II is that this argument of the moral equivalency, that really we had good versus evil. And, you know, in the case of Churchill, Churchill was brave and was kind of like the indispensable man responsible for the defeat of Hitler. It was necessary because had he not done so, you know, even though it was at great cost that, you know, Britain lost its empire as a result of it, it was still worth it because had he not done so, we would have had a Nazi government and it probably would have been the strongest power in Europe. So what do you have to say about that?
So there's two things there. The first thing you said about there can't be a moral equivalence. There's two ways to approach that one. Usually what, for example, Coleman Hughes said is that there can't be a moral equivalence. Hamas is killing innocent people and you don't have Israel doing that. And then he says, okay, well, Israel is killing innocent people, but they're not intending to do it. If they could avoid it, they absolutely would. And then you get a number of atrocities, to which Coleman Hughes changes and says, well, roughly 1% of all populations are psychopaths. So yes, 1% of the Israeli government is doing this, but that's not indicative of all that's going on there. And the intentions of the people in Hamas are bad, whereas the intentions of the Israelis are inherently good. Two things to say about that. You seldom are really looking at the motives of the people that you're defending. So many times, since Lyndon Johnson's Great Society to Otto von Bismarck's idea for a welfare state in Prussia, people have how they sell their ideas to the public and the true motives behind them. If state operations were really well-intended and really virtuous, they would let us opt out of funding them, or they would be much more honest and upfront. And if things went wrong, we would get apologies. There'd be much more transparency. There would not be military conscription, and they would force people to engage in these things. So those are blatant red flags that this is not a virtuous operation with well-intended people. So the first thing they do is they don't see clearly the motives of their actual side. They just take a very surface level analysis without saying, well, how do we know this is true? For example, the war for democracy, Churchill was not elected in 1940. He was appointed. Charles de Gaulle, the French government in exile, was not elected. Joseph Stalin was not elected, but it's still a war for democracy. Franklin Roosevelt was putting hundreds of thousands of German, Italian, and Japanese Americans into internment camps. He was confiscating the nation's gold. He was starting the first ever draft in peacetime in 1940. He was secretly planning at the Atlantic Charter in Canada with Winston Churchill in August of 1941, saying that we will certainly come in on your side. We're going to be provocative in the islands in order to get in on your side. This is according to an article titled War Entry Plans Laid to Roosevelt in, January 2nd of 1972. It was published, but it's discussing the August 1941 meeting in Canada between Roosevelt and Churchill. So again, you can't look at all this and say, oh yeah, the motives are totally pure, so that there can't be a moral equivalence. The other thing is, they constantly lie about the motives of the other side. The way this is usually sold is they will say what Putin wants is, and as they're listing the things that Putin wants, they'll have a video of him on the screen talking, but the audio isn't the words that he's saying. It's the commentator talking over him. They do this with Putin. They do it with Hitler. They do it with Osama bin Laden. It was so shocking to so many people when the TikTok trend of Osama bin Laden's letter to America started getting out, because we had never actually heard the intentions. So if Coleman Hughes and Douglas Murray and Barry Weiss and Ben Shapiro want to actually make a comparison, you want to steel man the Hamas position and steel man the IDF position. You then want to criticize in every way possible the Hamas position, on their motives and compare it to their actions, and then criticize the Israeli intentions and criticize the Israeli actions. That's an actual cost-benefit analysis in order to justify philosophically who's in the right and who's in the wrong. What are they comparing ideas to ideas, comparing actions to actions? If they want to really know what the motives of Hamas are, you can check out the Hamas Media Office. They had a publication. It's titled Operation Al-Aqsa Flood, Our Narrative. And this was published right after October 7th. Now, the incentive for terrorists when a tragedy happens, they have more attention on them than ever before. So what are they going to talk about? According to Ben Shapiro and Douglas Murray, they're just going to have a Quran and they're just going to start reading from it because the goal is to spread the Islamic caliphate. You'll be surprised to know that not much of the Quran is mentioned in this, not any more than, you know, Christianity or God bless us all would be mentioned by an American president. The people bring religion into it every now and then. But the document from the Hamas Media Office primarily mentions the occupation of Palestine, of Gaza, talks about Zionist aggression of the Ergon, Stern, and Haganah. It talks about Operation Cast Lead. It talks about Operation Pillar of Defense. It talks about the blockade since 2005. All secular reasons that they could give for such a thing. So, yeah, that is how I would respond. You have to look at the motives of both sides and compare the motives. Look at the actions of both sides and compare the actions. Every time you try to give Putin his say-so, well, then you start seeing it's not unprovoked. This was a result of NATO expansion into potentially Ukraine and maybe Georgia. In the case of Hamas, as I mentioned, you can read our narrative, Operation Al-Aqsa Flood, publication from the Hamas Media Office, which the Jewish Chronicle actually was circulating after October 7th. So this is a genuine document. And in the case of Hitler, you can read the last appeal to Great Britain, or you could read Hitler's speeches, 1922 to 1945, and then judge his surface level justifications. So every time they use that argument, I just know that they're a bunch of morons, because to say that one side is evil and one side is good, that when you have the same level of analysis that a 4-year-old has about a movie that they just saw, you might want to question it. It could be true, you know, could be Ted Bundy, but there are examples of pure good versus pure innocent. But when you're talking about a large scale like this, it's extraordinarily unlikely. There's one more quote I got to give from Churchill's book.
Go ahead.
This is from page 767. This is his Second World War memoirs, this collection of six books that he got the prize for. He said, so he's talking about a meeting that he had with Stalin, and he says, Stalin explained that the Russians had made considerable use of deception by means of dummy tanks, aircraft, and airfields. Just think about that. Stalin's making these fake things and putting them in the fields. That's just so funny to think about. Radio deception had also proved effective. He was entirely agreeable to the staffs collaborating with the object of devising joint cover and deception schemes. In wartime, I said, truth is so precious that she should always be attended by a bodyguard of lies. Stalin and his comrades greatly appreciated this remark when it was translated. And upon this note, our formal conference ended gaily. Page 767 of Memoirs of the Second World War. So you want to talk about, well, their motives are good, their motives are bad. I have a guy who wrote in his own book that he bombs civilians, that he engages in a truth that's so important that he protects it with an escort bodyguard of lies. At what point can we start questioning the motives of these other people? That's what I would say to people who say that.
Yeah. And even if we were to grant the idea that, you know, like this framing of good versus evil, this marvelized, you know, fiction of reality, you know, I think like if we were to grant this framing that, it's the civilization versus barbarianism that we constantly hear from the right. I think it's possible to simultaneously grant that, you know, Great Britain and the United States are superior cultures based off of superior ideas, and that Germany represented barbarianism. Like it's possible to grant that and then also say, but in specific context, when we're dealing with ethical questions and ethical scenarios, people with good ideas and people who are, you know, grounded in good ethics still can violate those ethics in specific situations. And it's almost like they're saying they're conflating two different things. They're saying Great Britain is good in one respect, and that they have good ideas, that they're based off of Western principles, and that somehow gives them moral capital to expend in certain situations in war. So they're able to commit atrocities because they have good ideas. But as you said, you're supposed to compare ideas with ideas and actions with actions. And I think that they're conflating the two.
Oh, yeah, that's a scam they always pull. They're like, yeah, this explicit thing that you're mentioning, well, instead of conceding that that's evil, let me talk about the overall justification.
Right.
Which is like, come on, man. If you have someone who's generally a good person who commits murder once against an innocent person, the fact that they engage in other behaviors that are also virtuous, or people who are part of their demographic or their nation also engage in very, you know, great achievements or very virtuous activities, that is just not justifying. You have to compare individual examples with individual examples and general cultures with general cultures. Mm-hmm. That's another way that they try and scam it. They'll say, look at this one incident and then compare it to the culture at large. So yeah, that is something that they do all the time, which I feel like they're getting away with much, much less once you just see the psychotic barbarity of, I mean, Ben Gavir and Smotrich. I don't know if you've seen those guys give speeches,
it's
but
insane.
These people are so psychotic that we're not just talking, or if you watch the documentary The Settlers, or if you look at the quotes that I just read from, you know, the works of Charles Webster and Noble Franklin, you go, well, if the other side saw this, what would they think about us? If they knew nothing about us except here are the most powerful people in Britain talking amongst each other about how to conduct warfare against the civilian population. Well, you would think that we're absolutely barbaric and totally crazy. So very good points, man.
Yeah. Well, did you watch Dave Smith and Alex Berenson's debate?
I had almost forgotten about it, and you just reminded me.
Well, it was honestly not really worth watching until the very end. And the point that was really significant that Dave brought up was like, why are we talking about World War II, something that happened in the 1940s and 1930s, when a genocide is currently happening right now? It's like every time we talk about wars that are going on in the world right now, you want to bring up something that happened in the last century. And I think that really is the overall theme of what we've been talking about right now, is like this myth keeps coming up because it's so crucial and it is so load bearing for the events that are happening right now in the world.
Yeah, and it definitely is one of those things where the lower the price, the higher the good will be consumed. So when the price of opposing the Nazis is this big, everyone's going to be consuming it. I hate Hitler. I hate Goring. I hate Himmler. Okay, that's very low. It doesn't cost you anything to say that, Alex.
Right.
So what value are you bringing to the table? But if it's something like, well, there is an ICC arrest warrant for Netanyahu. If he goes to Hungary and meets with Orban, he should be arrested. That would the price of saying that is a little more significant.
Right.
So, yeah, the price is so low that it's just overconsumed by the Alex Berensons of the world who think, oh, my God, in his example of Dave literally telling a joke as his proof of Holocaust denial.
It was unbelievable.
I realized I was humbled because I was totally wrong. Berenson tweeted like the day before. He goes, Dave Smith is in for a huge surprise. Never has he really been held accountable by a real reporter and journalist before. I go, oh, shit. I said, he's going to have something that we haven't thought of. And I'm thinking like, all the conversations that Dave has probably had, could there have been like a Project Veritas kind of situation? I assumed he would have gone to what Chris Cuomo did and mentioned Legion of Skanks or something like that. And I'm like, oh, what's he going to have? So I went to watch I stupidly thought he would have a point. Instead, he, after watching the clip twice, Berenson says, should we watch it again?
Yeah, like, it was so crazy, man.
They have so little. And I would love to debate Alex Berenson on that issue, on what he thinks happened, because he seems very confident about something that when Dave asked, what do you mean by Holocaust denial? He said, it's not me saying it, it's Yad Vashem saying it. I have read more about this topic than I care to ever concede. And I can tell you, absolutely it happened, Alex. I don't think you know why it happened. I think you just want the popular opinion. If I asked you for primary evidence as to what evidence you have that it happened, what about the people who face cross-examination for their claims? What would Berenson say to that? Is he referring to documents? Does he have specific people who are at these camps who are part of the Einsatzgruppen on the Eastern Front in Russia carrying out these operations? Does he know who Fritz Reinhardt is as opposed to Reinhard Heydrich? I bet he doesn't. So he's not even saying, Dave, good people believe this, it happened. Bad people believe it didn't happen. Do you believe in this evidence or that evidence? That's how I determine your morality. It's so pathetic that I just don't know where they get the concept that in order for me to judge whether or not you're a good or bad person is based on whether you believe this empirical evidence or you disbelieve it. Like right. That would be a judge of how you are. Maybe it's because you haven't been introduced to the information. Maybe because you have other things going on in your life. Maybe you've heard opposing views and you could have a conversation about it. But yeah, it's just so pathetic and it's just overconsumed because the price is so low.
100%. Well, I wanted to ask you one more thing. It's kind of a little off topic. And I think we should do another podcast maybe on Japan and the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But in your article, Justifying Evil, you talk about Captain Arthur McCollum. And I wanted to bring him up because my last name is McCollum. When I discovered that this was a thing, that the McCollum memo was a thing, I told Scott that it is now my purpose in life to be even more anti-war than I was before, just to vindicate my name. So I wanted to ask you about the McCollum memo and the evidence that FDR was actually planning to get involved earlier, because Justin Raimondo in Reclaiming the American Right, he provides evidence that Burton Wheeler, Montana senator, so he was a senator from my state, was a huge supporter of FDR. And then he got evidence in December of 41, I want to say, that FDR had actually planned to get involved in the war. And he was a Democrat who had supported FDR because of his budget policy. He had actually said that he didn't want to increase the debt at all, and then ended up, obviously, like with the New Deal and then getting involved in World War II. And Burton Wheeler was radicalized by it and became an anti-war guy, kind of the America First Committee. So what evidence do we have and what is in the McCollum memo?
So a little background. With this stuff, it's so hard to pick when to start this timeline. So as you mentioned, you had Herbert Hoover, who increased federal spending every single year he was in office. By the end of his administration, he had increased federal spending by, I think it was 48%. He had the Smoot-Hawley tariffs. He had these farm boards and wage and price controls. So Roosevelt runs generally on, you know, opposing this drastic increase in the federal government, where he had said that there was reckless spending. Well, once he now had the power to control the spending and he would reap benefits from it, well, he has a new idea that he calls the New Deal with America. A drastic increase even over Hoover's spending. So he said this would bring us out of the Depression. And by 1937, after 4 years of the New Deal, U.S. unemployment was at 20%. So what happens in this case is politicians now have an incentive when they say, I'm going to fix this, and they don't have the knowledge or the incentives to fix X, the thing you can verify as to whether or not they fix it. They say, well, I'll fix this later. There's actually something else that I want you to focus on that we need to solve. And here you're not really going to be able to verify whether I'm telling the truth or I'm telling the lies, because all the evidence that I have is actually confidential. So they engage in diversionary foreign policy when their domestic operations are not going successfully. You had mentioned Roosevelt planned in December of 41 to get in. It's so hard to know the exact date because he was authorizing lend-lease to the British and the Bolsheviks before then. Does that count as him being in the war? I certainly think it technically does. The most blatant example is the article I mentioned earlier. This was, I want to get the exact material right. This would have been August of 41. Lord have mercy. Where is it? I guess I could just summarize it. It's here it is. War entry plans laid to Roosevelt, published by the New York Times, January 2nd of 1972. Here are excerpts from the article. President Franklin D. Roosevelt told Prime Minister Winston Churchill in August 1941 that he was looking for an incident to justify opening hostilities against Nazi Germany. The minutes, quoting Churchill indirectly, said, he, Roosevelt, obviously was determined that they should come in. If he were to put the issue of peace and war to Congress, they would debate it for months, the cabinet minutes added. The president said he would wage war but not declare it, and that he would become more and more provocative. If the Germans did not like it, they could attack American forces. The president ordered these U.S. Navy escorts. They were to attack any German U-boat which showed itself, even if it were 200 or 3 miles away from the convoy. Everything was to be done to force an incident. The president had taken this very well and made it clear that he would look for an incident which would justify him in opening hostilities, Churchill told the War Cabinet. These are direct quotes from Winston Churchill after talking to President Roosevelt. So the initial plan. So this is the thing with when people are conspiring, they generally have multiple things that they can reach from. They don't have one plan which they execute and everything goes perfectly. They generally have four or five things that don't work out and one of them does. So the original plan was to have a ship called the USS Greer, referred to as the Greer incident. It was supposed to be flying right under a British airplane. And when the Germans went to attack it because of the British airplane, they would hit an American ship. This is summarized in Henry Kissinger's book, Diplomacy, where he says, one of the most brilliant pieces of statecraft that I've seen is Franklin Roosevelt's handling of the Greer incident. So it's well known. The original plan was to get the U.S. into war on behalf of Britain by way of Germany. Germany ends up declaring war against America on December 11th of 1941, but the operation that was successful was the freezing of Japanese assets and the occupation of the Philippines and Singapore and Hawaiian islands. So that is the one that ended up being successful. So we know that his intentions, and also he started the first peacetime draft, as I mentioned earlier. So that's another way you could look at the intentions of the people actually in a position to know what's going on and what they really wanted. They weren't saying things like, here's how we're going to make peace. Here's what we could do to avoid provocations. Here's, how I'm going to serve the American people. If they don't want to fight in this war, they won't be drafted. It'll only be funded through bonds and people would voluntarily fund it. None of that at all. It's just the classic domestic imperialism. So Arthur McCollum was the chief of the Far Eastern section of Naval Intelligence. And his name is mentioned repeatedly in the Pearl Harbor meetings, such as the Roberts Committee and all of these things. So he's someone in a position to have influence. This memo was written on October 7th of 1940, and it goes through 10 things that he would like the U.S. policy to start engaging in. I'll read sections 9 and 10. Number 9, it is not believed that the present state of political opinion in the United States government is capable of declaring war against Japan without more ado, and it is barely possible that vigorous action on our part might lead the Japanese to modify their attitude. Therefore, the following course of action is suggested. Make an arrangement with Britain for the use of British bases in the Pacific, particularly Singapore. Make an agreement with Holland for the use of base facilities and acquisition of supplies in the Dutch East Indies. give all possible aid to the Chinese government of Chiang Kai-shek, send a division of long-range heavy cruisers to the Orient, Philippines, or Singapore, send two divisions of submarines to the Orient, keep the main strength of the U.S. fleet now in the Pacific in the vicinity of the Hawaiian Islands, completely embargo all U.S. trade with Japan in collaboration with a similar embargo imposed by the British Empire. If by these means Japan could be led to commit an overt act of war, so much the better. At all events, we must be fully prepared to accept the threat of war. Does this sound like a person who's just trying to stay out of things? Does this sound like the isolationist America that we're constantly told by the historians that we actually were? And it's very plausible that the average American was in 1940. They had just had 116,000 American deaths in the First World War, just between 1917, 18, and 19. 116,000 conscript deaths mostly. So yeah, I'm sure they were isolationists. But what incentive do the political figures face? They don't have to meet consumer demand. They not only get money whether or not people want to fund them, they tend to get more power when they don't keep you safe. Just as Roosevelt obviously did after Pearl Harbor, just as George Bush obviously did after not keeping us safe on September 11th of 2001. So the best reason we have to believe that this is a genuine document is a corroborating document from the Joseph P. Kennedy archives. Joseph P. Kennedy was the U.S. ambassador to the United Kingdom from 1938 to 1941. It's titled Secret Memorandum for the Ambassador. Subject, Blue-Orange Situation from A.G. Kirk. His name is Alan Goodrich, if you want to look him up. He was a captain of the U.S. Navy, and this was on October 9th of 1940. So 2 days later, we have someone in a high position of power saying something very similar. I don't know this for sure, but if I had to bet money, Blue-Orange Situation means American-Japanese situation. Blue, I believe, means America. Orange means Japan. And that's from reading this. I'll just summarize the important parts. General Plan Blue, to establish U.S. fleet or major portion thereof in Singapore area in order to secure position for attacking Orange, vital lines of communication, and projecting operations against Orange homeland. Alternative Basic Plan Blue, as an alternative, might base U.S. fleet in Hawaii and conduct raids against Orange homeland with fast squadrons using Aleutians as desired. This plan brings war directly into Orange homeland with consequent disruption to war effort and political life. So before Pearl Harbor, you have people in high positions talking about provoking a war. And then it's not just things that they said and never came to fruition. There was the freezing of Japanese assets. There was the Export Control Act of 1940. And there was moving of a large fleet to Hawaii. Hawaii was not a state until 1959. So it's not like, of course, the Americans are there. That was not just something inevitable. The biggest piece of evidence comes from the George Marshall Foundation. George Marshall was the chief of staff for the United States Army, I believe his title was. This is a document titled 2602, Robert L. Sherrod Memorandum for David W. Hulbert, November 15th of 1941. I found this in the archives of the General Marshall Foundation. It's titled General Marshall's Conference Today, November 15th of 1941. The U.S. is on the brink of war with the Japanese, said the general. Our position is highly favorable in this respect. We have access to a leak of all the information they are receiving concerning our military preparations, especially in the Philippines. In other words, we know what they know about us, and they don't know that we know it. Under great secrecy, the U.S. is building up its strength in the Philippines to level far higher than the Japanese imagine. General MacArthur is unloading ships at night, is building airfields in the carefully guarded interior, is allowing no one within miles of military reservations. Most important point to remember is this. We are preparing for an offensive war against Japan, whereas the Japs believe we are preparing only to defend the Philippines. We are piling a large portion of our new material into the Philippines, several shiploads a week of it. If a war with Japanese does come, we'll fight mercilessly. Flying fortresses will be dispatched immediately to set the paper cities of Japan on fire. There won't be any hesitation about bombing civilians. It will be all out.
Wow.
The way it's sold to us is stupid America just believed in isolationism. They were twiddling their thumbs doing nothing. No, the politicians were actively provoking wars with Germany and Japan, funding the British with armaments, as they did in the First World War, funding the Bolsheviks with extensions on Lend-Lease. Of course, they sent aid to Chiang Kai-shek. That's well known as part of Lend-Lease and arguably the Marshall Plan, depending on how you really define allocation of the Marshall Plan goods. So these things actually came to fruition. That's it. It's multiple people in a position to know what they're talking about. We're citing primary documents, and the things they spoke about came to fruition. And this was their intentions. Two final pieces of evidence, because there's actually a lot more. But I'll end with quotations from Henry Simpson, who was the Secretary of War. I forget which years, but certainly through the Second World War period, before and during. Henry Simpson said let's start with on December 7th of 1941, the day of Pearl Harbor. He wrote a book with his brother Bundy Simpson, and it's titled On Active Service in Peace and War. This is from page 393. When the news first came that Japan had attacked us, my first feeling was of relief that the indecision was over and that a crisis had come in a way which would unite all our people. This continued to be my dominant feeling in spite of the news of catastrophes which quickly developed, for I feel this country united has practically nothing to fear, while the apathy and divisions stirred up by unpatriotic men have been hitherto very discouraging. Is that someone who sounds like, oh no, we just wanted peace and now we have war. Now we haven't really talked about whether or not we'd have a war because we're such isolationists. We had no clue this would happen. Why would they do this? You don't get any of that. They go, finally, the shackles are off of me. Now let's get to the war that we've been planning for some time. The big one comes from the Pearl Harbor investigation. This was in 1946, and it was, gosh, it's amazing that the first person to popularize this was a guy named George Morgenstern, and it was in a book titled The Secret of Pearl Harbor. I got it right here. What is it called? It's Pearl Harbor, The Story of the Secret War. And that was in 1948 this material came about. So he cites the primary document, which you can find on archive.org, Investigation of the Pearl Harbor Attack. This is his diary entry on November 25th of 1941. Here, the Secretary of State, Henry Simpson, said in his diary, General Marshall, the guy who I mentioned in the first document, another reference point so you can corroborate and see if these stories match. General Marshall and I went to the White House, where we were until nearly 1:30 at the meeting where Secretary of State Cordell Hull, Secretary of the Navy Frank Knox, Chief of Staff of the Army George C. Marshall, Chief of Naval Operations Harold Ramsford Stark, and myself. The President brought up the event that we were likely to be attacked, perhaps as soon as next Monday, for the Japanese are notorious for making an attack without warning. And the question was what we should do. The question was how we should maneuver them into the position of firing the first shot without allowing too much danger to ourselves. Does that sound like someone who is just an isolationist, dying to make peace with anyone, terrified up all at all hours of the night saying, how do I keep the American people safe? How do I be transparent in my role as a public servant? No, those are all progressive fantasies and neocon fantasies that they sell us about the reality of these situations. Whereas the Austrian school and libertarian capitalists realize that all members of the human race are self-interested. The difference between statism and capitalism is capitalism harmonizes this inevitable self-interest to the point where you can't get anything from me unless you create value in a mutually beneficial arrangement. The socialists get access to property regardless of whether or not they create value, whether they're part of the military-industrial complex or they're just a local thief. This gets to the heart of the issue. So when you understand what government is, the monopolist gang in a geographical area, this stuff doesn't really surprise you. But if you think government is when we come together and help the public, then this is like completely shocking. And you cannot believe any of this happened. But if you understand that what makes government a unique institution is they have the right to do things to you, which you don't have to do to them, and then claim to represent you. Just if the example I use in my book, Domestic Imperialism, if the Catholic Church did what the government does constantly, the Catholic Church would literally be called a terrorist organization. So why does this double standard exist? In order to get this double standard to be, it's not, even if it's not accepted by the people, so long as they don't actively resist it, then it's beneficial for the state. But the only way they can do it is with massive amounts of propaganda. So we should expect by default, we're going to have wars and economic illiteracy. They're going to lie to us, and there's going to be tons of propaganda. Once you recognize what the state is, then those four things are just defaults. You assume you'll get it from both the Mexican drug cartel, the U.S. government, the German government, the Chinese government. So we can end there. That was a great Ron Paul lesson, is don't have double standards for the government. That's a good rule of thumb. And once you understand that, all of this should not really be surprising to you. But for the Douglas Murrays, who I know have made it through all 1 hour and 40 minutes of this because they're so open-minded and so tolerant, and they just love the diversity that Israel has, that Qatar doesn't, I really hope that they can get back to me and let me know if any of these terrible things that I've said, if you have any refutation or you just want to call me an anti-Semite. Liam, thank you for having me on, brother.
Of course. And you make a very convincing case that the foreign policy is just an extension of the domestic imperialism you discuss in your book. And I'll make sure to link your articles, The Ultimate Case Against the Churchill Cult and Justifying Evil, in the description below. Where else can people find your stuff?
LibertarianInstitute.org. That's where Scott Horton and I are creating a free educational archive for all things libertarian, foreign and domestic. Our general goals are promote the concept of peace, mutually beneficial voluntary exchanges. We want to decriminalize capitalist acts between consenting adults and expose the war propaganda as efficiently as possible.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Keith.
Take care, man.
Thanks for tuning into The Liam McCollum Show, a podcast by Human Reaction. Check out the Human Reaction weekly podcast hosted by Joe Sheehan, David Rand, and Kyle Mack. And make sure to like, comment, and subscribe to both of our channels.